Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, Pope Benedict's new book, Jesus of Nazareth, will hit bookshelves this coming Monday, just in time for the pontiff's 80th birthday. An inspirational look at the Taizé community. We speak with its new leader, Brother Alois. And reflecting on the supper at Emmaus, why did Christ hide his identity from his disciples? And where can you find this gospel story depicted in art? Pope Benedict's first book as pontiff will hit the shelves of bookstores next week, just in time for his 80th birthday on Monday. In the 448-page book entitled Jesus of Nazareth, the Pope examines the life of Christ in a very personal and pastoral way. In his foreword, Joseph Ratzinger notes the work reflects his personal search for the face of the Lord and is meant to help foster in the reader a living relationship with Jesus Christ. Well, in this, the first part of an anticipated two-volume work, the Pope examines Jesus' public life from his baptism in the River Jordan to the Transfiguration, when his divinity was revealed to his disciples on Mount Tabor. The Pope hopes to reflect on the infancy of Jesus and on his passion, death, and resurrection in a second volume already in the planning stages. Well, Volume 1 will be issued simultaneously in Italian, German, and Polish editions on Monday, April 16th, and eventually will be available in 20 languages. The English edition is due out in bookstores on May 15th. One of Pope John Paul II's and Pope Benedict's deepest wishes has been the union of Christianity's churches of East and West. For well over half a century, a once small community in France's southern Burgundy region has been trying to put that desire into practice. Taizé has grown into a worldwide ecumenical movement, especially involving young people. It has become a byword for ecumenism based on prayer and meditation. Taizé is the name of a unique monastic community in France that groups more than 100 men, Protestants and Catholics, from 25 different nations. Young people from all over the world visit Taizé to be part of community life for a week at a time. Depending on the season, the number of young visitors each week ranges from a few hundred in the winter months to several thousand during the summer vacation period. During Holy Week leading up to Easter, more than 10,000 young people flock to the community, by far the highest number of visitors of the whole year. The Taizé community was founded in 1940 by Brother Roger, who remained its leader until he was killed in 2005. Its current prior is Brother Alois, a German Catholic appointed by Brother Roger to be his successor. In a recent visit to Rome, Brother Alois was received in audience by Pope Benedict. Afterwards, he spoke to Susie Hodges about the Taizé philosophy and his meeting with the Pope.
He had so touching, wonderful words about Brother Roger after the death of Brother Roger, and still 1 year afterwards, at the anniversary of the death of Brother Roger, he spoke in such deep words about him, and this created for us a very deep link. And he was very interested in how the community continues and what is happening with the young people. Yes.
And what message did he give you for the Taizé community?
He encouraged to continue on the way of looking for Christ, going towards Christ with the young people in the communion of the church. And this was also the message of Brother Roger. We cannot find Christ without the communion of the church. To open ourselves for the others and to look for Christ, this is the same movement. And I think it's the same perspective that we have in Taizé together with the Holy Father.
And what do you think makes Taizé unique? Because it's often described that way, isn't it?
No, we are not unique. We are one community, a monastic community that lives in the church and that wants to give a contribution for reconciliation and today for the question how to transmit faith to the next generation. But we do this together with so many people.
Now, I know that Tézé is visited each year by thousands and thousands of young people. What do they tell you they're seeking?
A sense for their life. And I think for many young people, this is really an existential question now that they bring. They formulate it less or more clearly, but they come with this question. And what can give sense to my life? How is it possible to believe today in God in our modern society where we are minority? Young people suffer sometimes from the fact that looking for faith brings them in a situation of minority. Nobody understands this. And to deal with these situations, that's important.
And what kind of feedback do you get afterwards? Can you tell us about some particularly memorable feedback you get from some of these young people? Some chance remark?
Or so many letters we receive, or young people who come back. Often they say, for example, in Tézé, the silence has been important for me. And isn't this astonishing? In our society, where young people want to always to have a noise and always fill out silence, because silence means solitude. The modern life does not give a place for silence. Very often they say silence has been important, and this means that they discover perhaps in Tézé a deeper longing that is present but that does not come to the surface in daily life. The same thing with simplicity. People say the simplicity in the life of Tézé, it has to be simple because the young people give a financial contribution to the life there and we cannot have very luxurious means in Tézé. But the simplicity, and this also goes against the modern life, so a deeper longing is awakened.
How easy was it for the Tézé community to carry on after the horrifying assassination of Brother Roger, an act of violence in a community of peace?
Yes, it was horrifying, yes. But at the same time, we were carried, and I cannot say it in a different way, we were carried by God and by the communion of the Church. And this allowed that we continued immediately to continue to welcome the young people, to continue the prayer life, to continue with the European meetings, to go to Calcutta, to go now to Bolivia, to go into the situations of the young people. And now I can say that the young people understood that Brother Roger did not point towards himself, but like John the Baptist, he pointed towards Christ and towards the communion of the Church. And the young people understand this, and the prayer life continues in the same, with the same intense way. And we were astonished that during last summer there were more young people coming than before.
How many young people do you get on average a week during the summer?
3,000, 4,000, 5,000 each week. And from all the countries and other continents also. Those coming from other continents are prepared by their local churches and they stay for 2 or 3 months in Tézé. But the people from Europe only stay for 1 week. Some do stay another week for having a week of retreat in silence. But for example, from Romania, we have each week 10 buses coming. And most of them are Orthodox, but also Catholics and Protestants.
You are a musician, and I know you've written many of the newer Tézé songs, which are sung throughout the world today. How easy is it for you to write these songs? Do you get a sudden flash of inspiration? And what are the main themes of them?
Oh, we speak together among the brothers. What can be the text? Because it's the words that we want to sing, and it's words from the Psalms, from the Bible, but also from the tradition of the Church. We have to decide the language. We sing in Latin, because this still unites the young people from everywhere. So we have some Latin songs that we sing, but also we sing in different languages. And then we find a melody and a harmony and we start to sing.
finally, how do you foresee Taizé's future? Are you seeing any change or shift in its activities or its direction or the countries where you'll be involved?
Oh, we still have to go further step by step concerning this question. But the fact that we have smaller youth meetings on other continents, it's something that Brother Roger did. He went to India, to the Philippines, to South Africa, to Latin America. But we want to revive this now, to have youth meetings on the other continents too.
And do you find that these young people who are getting together with people of other religions, it's breaking down their prejudices about somebody who doesn't share the same faith as them?
Oh, it's a long way, you know, but if we can diminish the fears of one another, because these fears are source of misunderstandings and then even hatred and not having peace. If we can tear down the barriers of fear a little bit, then it's a contribution for peace.
Thanks there to Taizé Pryor, Brother Alois, who was speaking to my colleague Susie Hodges. Well, for more information on the Taizé community, check out their website. That's Taizé, T-A-I-Z-E, .fr for France. The story of Christ's empty tomb spread like wildfire throughout Jerusalem. It was the day Mary Magdalene ran to tell Simon Peter and John that Jesus' body was no longer there. 3 days had passed since his crucifixion on Mount Calvary, and some of his disciples had dispersed out of fear they might be next to face the executioner. In his Gospel, St. Luke recounts the tale of two disciples on the road to Emmaus, a village not far from Jerusalem. On their way, they meet a stranger who turns out to be Jesus himself. While no one knows for sure where the biblical Emmaus is in present-day Israel or the West Bank, scholars have indicated at least three or even more villages that may fit the description of the town and its location between 7 and 20 miles from Jerusalem. Nonetheless, the gospel story is central to Christian belief in the resurrection and the Eucharistic sacrifice. In the Catholic Church, Emmaus has been named a titular see. Well, to understand the story more fully, scholar and author Father Peter Stravinskas takes us on that dusty road to Emmaus for Jesus' encounter with his disciples.
As you recall, on Easter night, our Lord encounters two disciples hightailing it out of Jerusalem. Clearly, they think the show is over, and what happened to the Master, they don't want to happen to them, so they're getting out of the line of fire. And they're encountered on the road by a stranger. I should note that this is one of my favorite passages in the New Testament. In fact, I wrote my master's thesis in theology on this passage. But this stranger encounters them. And as happens frequently in these post-resurrection appearances, it turns out to be the risen Lord. And for some reason, they're not able to perceive him clearly for who he is. Obviously, he has a changed appearance, a transformed, a transfigured, glorified body. There's continuity between his previous earthly existence and now his risen life, but there are also points of discontinuity. The points of continuity, of course, it's a real body, because for apologetical reasons, the evangelists tell us he ate and he drank and he spoke and he walked and so forth. So it's a real body. And interestingly enough, even in that risen body, he bears the wounds of his crucifixion. And we can come back to that in another moment. That's not directly related to the Emmaus story. At the same time, there's discontinuity. He's able to pop in and out of places at will. And for one reason or another, he's not clearly identifiable by facial features. Mary Magdalene, we remember, recognizes him by his voice. In this episode, St. Luke says the disciples were kept from recognizing him. And they start to chat. And he said, "You look downcast. What's the problem?" "Well, you know, are you the only man in Jerusalem who hasn't heard what's gone on there these past couple of days?" "What things?" And they tell him what has happened. And then he proceeds to explain all of the Old Testament scriptures to them that refer to the passion and death of the Messiah. And they're intrigued by this, and they're approaching an inn, at which point they invite him to come in with them. Why? Because they want the conversation to keep going. Somehow or other, what he has said has sparked hope in them, or rekindled hope, perhaps is better. And then he sits down at a table with them, and we're told by Luke that he took the bread, blessed it, and broke it. Now, we hearing those words today immediately think we're at Mass. The early Christians, of course, were also using the exact same formula. And it says, in that instant, they recognized him. And then Luke says something very, very strange, and he disappeared from their sight. Well, what's gone on here? Well, as a matter of fact, what we've had is a reenactment of the Mass. The first half, the Liturgy of the Word, this stranger, who turns out to be the Lord, has opened up for them his sacred word, and he's explained it to them. Well, that's what happens in the first half of every Mass. In the second part, they sit down, and he breaks bread, blesses it, gives it to them. In that moment, they recognize him, and he vanishes. Why? Because having the Eucharistic Christ, one does not need the historical Christ. It's fulfilled in the sacramental moment. And then they go back and they give this information to the disciples. And it's a very touching and somewhat amusing situation at the same time. They say the Lord, they're getting ready to say that the Lord has been raised. And they're greeted with, "The Lord has been raised. It's true. He has appeared to Simon." The evidence for the resurrection is not the appearance to the two disciples. It's not the appearance to Mary Magdalene. It's the appearance to Simon Peter, the Prince of the Apostles. Those apparitions of the risen Lord to Mary Magdalene, to the two disciples, or any others, are all good and wonderful, but they have to be validated by the Prince of the Apostles. And the appearance of Jesus to Simon gives validity to all those other experiences of the risen Christ. In some sense, this Emmaus story is a mini catechism. It gives us all of the essential information we need in one chapter of Luke's Gospel, chapter 24. And it's done through the medium, really, of a play. The actors are very, very real. They're palpable. And the message is incredibly inspiring. And it's a reminder to us that we who live 2,000 years after the death and resurrection of Jesus are no worse off than the apostles who walked and talked with him 2,000 years earlier, because our access to the risen Christ is every bit as possible and real through the Holy Eucharist as was their experience of him as he walked the roads of Galilee.
But why didn't he want them to recognize him from the beginning?
I suspect it's because he wants them to recognize him in the way that all Christians thereafter will have to recognize him, in the Eucharist. You know, he says to Mary Magdalene, "Don't touch me," because she's still focused on a very natural relationship with him.
She recognizes his voice.
Right. And then she reaches out to touch him. And he says, "Don't do that." Now, what we do find is, with St. Thomas a week later, he tells him to touch him. Of course, there's also the difference. Thomas is one of the 12. His access to Christ can be very, very different, and would be the difference today between a layperson and a priest. There's a qualitative difference in the relationship, and we have to understand that that's part of the Lord's will for the church, the hierarchical structure of the church. But with Mary Magdalene, she perceives him as the risen Christ, but it's important that she try to put aside those natural connotations that she's had, which are not bad, but they're superseded. It's no different from what our Lord says when that woman in the crowd praises Our Lady and says, "Blessed is the womb that bore you and the breast that fed you." And he said, "Rather, those who hear the word of God and put it into practice." Nothing wrong with his relationship, his natural relationship with his mother. But that would be fulfilled in a much, much deeper relationship, which was not based on blood, but based on discipleship.
Father Peter Stravinskis is founder of the Priestly Society of the Venerable Cardinal John Henry Newman and editor of The Catholic Response. Perhaps two of the most famous pieces of art depicting the gospel story of Emmaus were painted here in Rome by one of the Baroque era's most renowned artists. Though they're not found here in Rome any longer, Caravaggio's two paintings of Emmaus are among the must-knows found in any art history student's textbook. Art historian Elizabeth Leff flips through the pages for us.
The Supper at Emmaus was painted by Caravaggio twice. It was so popular, it was so well received that he, at 5 years' distance, was asked to paint a second one. And there, one is in London, and the other one ended up someplace else in Italy, I believe. And so we don't have them here in Rome. Although the meditation that produced it was distinctly Roman. It's a subject matter, the Supper at Emmaus, that takes a certain amount of, it comes into its own, let's say, in the 17th century, right at the cusp of the Baroque era, and fits very well with the programs and the ideas of the artists who painted it, who beyond Caravaggio were also Rembrandt van Rijn and Diego Velázquez.
What is so special about these particular paintings by Caravaggio? You were mentioning it's a moment of shock, of surprise, that here these young men are having, you know, a meal with this other man, and then all of a sudden, with the breaking of the bread and sharing of the wine, all of a sudden they realize, wow, this is the Lord, the risen Lord.
Well, the story of this is going back to the beginning of the Supper of Emmaus. Jesus runs into two apostles are walking down the road, and they're talking about the things that have happened. They've talked about, you know, the death of Christ, you know, how hard that was on them, talking about how the women came back, and we're talking about how Jesus wasn't in the tomb. And isn't this all so surprising? And what a time of turmoil. And with them comes another man, and they start to speak to him about things, and Jesus reprimands them. They don't recognize him as Jesus, but he reprimands them for not believing in their prophets. They're foolish. They don't listen. They don't believe. And they still don't get it, and they still keep along the path. Now, the moment that artists like to show is the tail end of this story, after the disciples find that they really like talking to this guy and that he's, you know, really brings them around, says, "Listen, it's getting to be nightfall. Why don't you come and we'll all have dinner together?" You can imagine doing this with any one of your friends, with any person you might meet on the street. You're getting along. Let's go sit down and have a meal. And during the course of the meal, when the guest takes the bread, he breaks the bread and he blesses the food, and then the scales fall from their eyes and they realize all this time they have been in the company of the divine. And the thing is that Caravaggio really figured out how to represent that shock in the midst of, you know, what almost seems to be the mundane. And his first version of this work, which was done around 1600, and the first version has a lot of show-offy stuff. I mean, he's a young artist, he's starting out, he wants people to know that he's really good at what he does, and a lot of people are very captivated when they see this painting in London, which has this this very vividly painted basket on the table with fruit on it. The basket looks like it's teetering off the table. This chicken with its two little legs sticking up off to the side. I mean, a very accurately, you know, almost photographic representation of the table. But around the table, you see this incredible gesture. One man's hand stretches straight out towards the viewer. The other man's elbow is pushed back very tightly, and you know that he's leaping backwards. And the light that Caravaggio has just begun to master in 1600 comes in and illuminates the painting. It illuminates the side of Christ's face, which is bent downwards as he blesses. And this creates a sort of dramatic entry of the light, of the dawning of comprehension in this painting. This is really a painting that suits Caravaggio's greatest gift to art in his period, which is the way that Caravaggio could really take the ordinary and make it extraordinary and make us understand that a scene like the Supper at Emmaus, it's meant to make us realize that the divine is in our lives, the supernatural is there, but we don't see it because we get kind of stuck on the mundane. But Caravaggio is able to infuse with that light, with that sense of being startled, the shock of recognizing Jesus in your life.
It almost seems that we are part of that dinner party.
It's another aspect of the painting, which again is a technical, like the foreshortening, is that if you ever stand in front of it, you'll figure out that the three figures are the fourth figure. There's the innkeeper who's sort of standing in the corner saying, what's going on here? But the figures that are standing around or sitting around the table are all our own size. And then the front of the table with the basket teetering towards us, kind of inviting us to come up and push the basket back into our place. So it's all our size, and so we're part of this. It's very much intended to draw the viewer into this recognition of Jesus is in your life.
Caravaggio was working in Rome. What were the other artists doing at that time?
Well, it wasn't really an overly popular subject matter at the time. The end of the 16th century and the beginning of the 17th century was more interested in a lot of saint paintings. You painted a lot of saints, you painted a lot of archangels. They were moving sort of away from Christological stories. It's a rather unusual subject matter to have Caravaggio take in hand and give such a definitive interpretation to. The other artists, people like Velázquez and Rembrandt, are working after Caravaggio, and therefore they draw a lot on what he did. It's a darkened room, and the light shines into the painting, and this kind of startled people standing around. But the other artists were also working in a more formal way towards getting the great artists of the time, not the kind of stuck-in-the-rut artists, but the really great artists, to name one, Annibale Carracci or even Guido Reni, the artists of this time who were working in another vein, they created paintings that were more formally acceptable. They didn't make the men sitting around the table look like normal men. The way that Caravaggio makes Jesus look sort of like a young, unshaven, long-haired, sort of almost you can imagine him as a Roman boy. The two men standing on either side look like the kind of people you'd see working in the streets of Rome. These other artists, they tend to give it a little bit more of an elegant feel, although they are also using foreshortening in these technical devices to draw you into the painting. But Caravaggio takes it one step further by turning the apostles into men on the street, by making the table look just like the dinner table of any person in the 17th century. So the story, just think of it as, a lot of the times people like to think of holy stories as happening a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away and not really pertinent to our day's life. But Caravaggio takes those stories and he puts them in the here and now for viewers.
Christian art and architecture historian Elizabeth Lev. She teaches at Duquesne University's Rome campus. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.